Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com. Full Service Radio.
Full service radio. Coronavirus full.
No. Oh no.
Monday is really trying to stop me from talking about coronavirus.
Oh, no. No more fear mongering.
I know. It's so much. It's so bad.
It's bad.
I love my brother. He texted me and he is the nicest person in the world. He's such a Pisces. And he was just like texting me all these things. I was like, I love you. But you know, I'm stressed out already and I'm always high stress. And this is stressing me out more.
I love you, but you're freaking me out.
But you're freaking me out right now. I was like, if it's our time, it's our time. You know, I'm just going to dress fabulously every time. Ooh, hello, hair.
Oh, my God.
Jesus Christ. Wow.
Fabio, is that you?
Fabio is
I can't believe it's not butter.
No, he's selling pharmaceuticals in that suit. Not fentanyl, just pharmaceuticals. Oh. Like aspirins. Oh. Like high-grade aspirins. You know? Or like really hippie birth control.
Oh. Oh, that took an interesting turn. Oh, hey, hi, hello.
Hello. Oh, my God, shit, the show's on.
Welcome to our world.
I forgot where I was for a moment. Hello, everyone. You're listening. This is, you know what, this reminds me of Madam Secretary with Taya Leone, a Sarah Lawrence graduate.
Oh, my goodness.
Where the show is like 15 minutes in and it finally gets to the credits, the opening credits. Yeah. And you're like, I thought they did that like 10 minutes ago.
Right.
That's what this is like. Welcome to the Beauty RKL, your fashion history comedy podcast, broadcasting live on Full Service Radio from the Line Hotel here in Washington, D.C. I am your host, Professor Noir, with...
Mix Monday.
Mix Monday is back.
Good to be back, yes.
Hey, there it is. This one... Oh my gosh.
Good to be back. Missed you guys.
We missed you. We had a wonderful guest last week, Queen Nefertiti.
Yes. Dear friend. Listening.
Yeah, it was a really great episode. And we're still talking about Josephine Baker. So don't think that we're not talking about Josephine Baker because the test on this is coming at the end of. There's no test.
Y'all better be ready for the pop quiz.
It's all analytical. Oh my God. How are you doing?
I am wonderful.
How's your trip?
My trip was amazing.
Where'd you go? Tell everyone.
Trying to hold in all that California sunshine while I'm out here in the gray snow days of D.C.
There's no snow days.
It snowed at my house this morning.
Did it really? Oh, yes. You live out in the magical forest.
I do.
You really do, where the deer and the antelope play. She's like, actually, sometimes they do. It's very violent.
Actually, that's real. No, it was an amazing trip. I got to go all up and down the coast of Cali, met up with my Funkadelic fam, and just really getting things moving forward. Finally feel like things are moving forward, really putting together a dope team of kind, talented people.
Yes.
And getting very clear on my concepts and all the details for each of my songs so that when I send them to... you know, the musicians and team members that I have all over the country. They'll be very clear on all the madness going on in my mind.
Stay glued to your phones, team. You're getting some content.
Yes. Yes. So I'm excited about it. You know, the more work you do, the more work you find out you have to do still.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a lot of work to do to meet my goals, but... Yes. It's cool to see like a team coming together so that we can really make a dope piece of art that lifts people up, makes people feel good about themselves and sexy and makes them want to dance.
Are you doing a mural? I'm just fucking with you.
Well, it's funny that you asked that because definitely Lisa Marie Thalhammer's Love Mural Tour will be a part of the release for
Ooh,
sure.
Ooh, that should be fun.
Yeah.
That should be really fun.
Yes.
Now, is there Love Mural Tour? Are they painting love murals all over the world? Like, what's happening?
The details are being ironed out right now, but she's definitely going to be going cross country, stopping in different cities where they need the love the most.
Okay.
Just covering the country with rainbows.
That's really awesome.
Yeah, for sure.
You guys should also think about, you know, I don't know, teaming up with, like, I don't know.
Yeah, the team. It's all about building a team.
I was going to say something, and I was like, I lost it, and I just... Sorry, everyone. Sorry.
No, you're right, though. It's really important to build a team, especially because one thing that I've realized and decided is that I am going to do this project fully DIY. You know, I was always thinking, like, oh, like I need a label, you know. Yes, like arts and crafts. I was always thinking, like, oh, I need a label for, like, financial backing and stuff like that. But
it's different times now.
It dawned on me, why do I need to seek out someone to take a piece of...
And suppress.
Of my creation.
To take a piece of your creation and also suppress a lot of your creativity.
Right, and tell me who I should be, what I should look like, what I should sound like.
I do that. No, I don't. I believe
And then I say, shut up.
Yeah, I was like, no one tells Mundy.
That's real.
No one puts baby in the corner.
Okay. But yeah, just really trying to claim that power, claim that creative control and keep it.
Yeah.
You know? And then also really trying to prioritize... self-care and keeping myself bright so that I can stay bright and bring that light and love and joy to other people, you know, because I can't bring that to other people if I'm not feeling bright.
I feel you. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Okay. It's all happening. Yes.
You're so pumped. Look at you. You're glowing.
Bitch, I am so excited.
If we were on video right now, you guys would be able to see Mundy is glowing right now.
Ding!
I understand. I'm doing a lot of work too. The nightlife does not stop.
Never.
I love the nightlife.
Can't stop.
It just won't stop.
Never, ever.
I'm hosting the Drag Race viewing party tonight at Trade.
Ooh!
With a porn star, which I'm very excited about.
Ooh!
I'm really pumped about that. I love a great porn star. I love a porn star moment.
Yeah.
They're always fun.
Yeah.
They're always fun. It always brings in just random people into a space. You're just like, why are you here?
I love it so much. And also, like...
Well,
all the sex work stigma needs to go away.
Yeah. Well, they're in town because Crew Club is closing.
Mm.
And so they're having like a big closing Roman Baths of Caracalla, like orgy fiesta, I assume. I don't know if there'll be food. I don't know if there'll be food. There should be food. I'm not making nice jokes. I'm actually talking about actual food. And I'm not going to this party specifically because I have to work the next day. But... if I find out that there was an actual food buffet at this, I'm going to be so pissed at myself.
Oh my God, it would have to be a sushi feast, like served by a naked body.
Yeah, my dream is to always go to a bathhouse and they have just this beautiful, like, dining a la française, like Louis XIV spread, like laid out. Just like glowing from like a beautiful room. That's just my dream.
And a nested bird feast.
Yeah, just a nested bird feast. Like, that's all I want. I know that's so random and like that does not really exist. And everyone, if you're listening to the show and if you're tuning in for the first time, yes, I am ridiculous. And if you've been tuning in, oh, he looks great.
He
this
really
outfit
does
is
look
everything.
Beautiful, yeah.
And if you're tuning in again for the first time, we get very distracted because we're in a glass enclosed box and we can see everyone.
Right.
And so we see a lot of people and we get very distracted by all the beautiful people here.
Squirrel!
plastic bag. Oh my God. Oh my God. Let's take a hot minute break because we, one, have a lot of content to cover because we're still talking about Josephine Baker.
Yeah.
She's done so much in her life and we've only gotten up to the 30s since last show.
Oh my God.
Like, and we're not even into World War II, which we're going to talk about.
Ooh.
I know. When it gets real, real.
Yes.
It gets real, real. But we'll be back. We'll take a little break. The Beauty RKO, your fashion history comedy podcast, we'll be back.
To see what Alexia is gonna play.
Alexia
the break.
Always plays the best jam.
Always something that makes me have to pop it.
Hello. Hi. Like, you are.
If I have to put my hands on my
delicious.
Knees and pop it about it.
Do you see this man that looks like an extra on The Talented Mr. Ripley? With this, like.
Oh my God.
What is that sound?
Is that the ocean?
It was a bomb because he was just...
Oh, because he was the bomb.
He was the bomb.
He is really cute. You see him, Alexia?
You love a man in a turtleneck.
I do. He is wearing this dove gray turtleneck and these like skinny...
He looked like he stepped out of the Muji store.
Like, oh my... I am happy with that. Give me a Muji man any day.
Any day.
Because he is, I need to stop staring at him. I need to do a show. I'm turning my back to him. I'm turning my back to him. Because that's
like, the hotties are out today.
I know, the hotties are really out. And I'm dressed like a freaking like swamp witch right now. I should have gone with the bodysuit. I should have worn the bodysuit.
Honey, swamp witch is everything.
I know. I mean, I look like a sexy swamp witch.
I literally look like a captain from Star Trek.
But that's not a problem because Star Trek Picard is very now. Thank you, CBS. Give us sponsorship.
Yes. Jean-Luc is now yesterday and the future.
It's yesterday and the future.
I love you, Jean-Luc.
Let's talk about Josephine Baker.
Oh, let's talk about the topic.
Let's talk about the topic.
Okay, great. ADD is real.
Welcome back to the Beauty Archeo, everyone. Again, we like to talk way into the show before reintroducing the show.
Because we're besties and we love to kiki about everything.
And this is a fashion history. This is a fashion history comedy podcast. We love to discuss history and laugh about it and joke about it and then also like get very passionate and cry about it and feel about it.
Totally. So, all the feels.
Get ready for the ride. Also, if you are listening to the show and you haven't subscribed, but please subscribe to us. You can download the podcast on Full Service Radio, or download on Apple Podcasts. Give us a 5-star review if you like what you hear.
Give us them 5 stars.
We love it. We want to get the word out there. We want to spread the love of history out there and tell the stories.
And we want to hear your reactions. So go ahead and leave a comment too.
Leave comments, tell us about it. Tell us about if you have a corrections moment. Let us know.
Yeah, be like, bitch, you got it wrong. We'll take it.
Yeah, we'll take it. We'll do a correction because we don't know everything and we still like to research and learn. So
exactly.
So the story of Josephine Baker continued. Wartime and the Renaissance.
Ooh.
So in September 1939, when France declared war on Germany in response to the invasion on Poland, Baker was recruited by the Deuxième Bureau. The 12th Bureau, French military intelligence, as a honorable correspondent, quote unquote. So basically, Baker would collect information, and she would collect information about German troops from locations where she met officials at parties. So the fact that, so at this point, Josephine Baker is like world renowned. It's like she's world famous.
Yeah.
And world known. She's not necessarily world loved because again, she is back in. She's back in the EU. She's back in Europe. She's back in France because she had an unsuccessful tour with the Ziegfeld Follies in the States. And they basically called her, like, you know, basically everything like close to like a bougie black princess who is like disconnected with black people. And she also didn't represent what black women looked like or represented at that time, nor did her voice. Like, she had a very small, like I call it the Barbieing of black women in entertainment, which happens quite often. She was made to have like this very tiny, lithe, you know, kind of like persona about her that was very delicate. And they tried to and that worked in Europe, but they tried to repackage that in America and it didn't work. And so she had a very unsuccessful tour and like ended up coming back because like I think they broke her contract like super early. I think like by the third show, the thing was like bombed. Oof. And people were also like offended that this black woman is starring in a Ziegfeld Follies show, which is like the height of whiteness. Like, let's be real.
Heaven
like,
forbid.
It is literally, it is the heaven of glowing fucking this man again.
Ooh, that hashtag BDE, hunty.
Girl. Speaking of black, he's gorgeous.
Ooh.
So anyway, back to the subject, because we can never, ever not be distracted. So she's back in France. It is 1939. France has declared war on Germany. They are now in World War II, and the shit is on. And at this time, there's a lot of... So in the First World War, the whole, like, I think establishment of the system of spies, international spies, became a thing. And then by the Second World War, it was definitely more refined, and... Who were spies is something that I think people often forget. That a lot of like celebrities, were used as spies. Socialites were used as spies. Chanel, Coco Chanel, we talked about
her
in her saga of episodes about how she was a spy for, you know, the wrong people, for the Nazis. But nonetheless, because of their access to each other, they were used as such.
You know, at the parties, get the dignitary to have a few drinkies, get a little loose with their tongue.
And that was her thing. It's like she specialized in like embassy parties, in ministries. She was very, very charming, all while like just gathering all this information.
Right.
Her Half-Face Society fame basically made her able to rub shoulders with Japanese officials to Italian bureaucrats. And then she was able to just go back and like report all this because no one would suspect the famous black woman. Number one. And no one suspected the black woman, too. It's like, a lot of people weren't necessarily suspected of being involved in European affairs.
Right.
I mean, they were very much so present in Europe, but still. When the Germans invaded France, Baker left Paris and went to Chateau Milan, which was the home she had purchased previously. So Chateau Le Milan was, and it still is considered, like, people know it's Justine Baker's historic home. I think someone else owns it now privately. If not, I think it's under like the National Bureau Trust of like historic homes in France. I think it's under both. But this chateau was like heaven.
Yeah.
I mean, she, with all of her money and all of her fame, built her fairy tale castle that she always wanted to live in and renovated and turned it into this beautiful, beautiful palace.
Mm-hmm.
So she escaped back to Chateau Le Milan. And the thing also back in those days, too, is that a lot of like war was being fought both in the cities and on the countryside. And so to escape back to her countryside home, yes, it was a sense of relief because she's out of the bureaucracy and the danger of communicating with all these different officials and enemies. However, the war is just steps away from her and walking up to her door very soon.
Yeah.
What were you about to say? You're about to say something, Mundy. Oh, no?
Just, you know, the...
You had your lips pursed and you're just like, the eyes got really big. And I'm like, I'm going on my thing again.
This is what happens. Pussy reads my mind and then I get in trouble. I'm just thinking about how incredibly smart she was and what a difficult time that was for her, because not only was her career kind of like in a confusing place with her contract getting canceled and stuff, but then all this political pressure was being put on her. And because of her upbringing and everything, politics were very important to her, and making a difference in a political way was definitely a priority for her.
Yeah.
But like, of course she had to escape.
And it's interesting too, is like, again, she's one of those superstars that really established celebrities being involved in politics.
Yeah.
In a major way, being like humanitarians in a major way.
Totally. I feel like she was such an Angelina Jolie.
No, Angelina Jolie is trying to be her.
Well, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because we're going to talk about that in just a second.
Right.
So with her establishment back at her house in France, in the movie, actually, the story of Justine Baker with Lynn Whitfield, which everyone should read, which everyone should see. It's a made-for-TV movie back in like the early 90s, but still amazing.
Go watch it.
And it's also the only movie ever made about Justine Baker.
That's wild.
Like biopic.
That's,
you know, and I'm just
me.
Like, there needs to be another one soon.
Yeah.
Because her life was so fucking interesting and so crazy, and you cannot make this shit up.
Right,
it
exactly.
writes itself.
Better than fiction.
It literally writes itself.
Mm-hmm.
That in the movie, they show like the Nazi party descending upon her home and kicking her out of her property and then escaping to France. And I'm not exactly sure because I never got full understanding of that actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
But while she was in her home, she did like house people that were part of the Free French effort led by Charles de Gaulle. And she also supplied them with visas. And again, still being that entertainer at the time, because she was still entertaining, she could still travel to like places all over Europe, Portugal. She could travel. She went to South America at one point. So she could literally take information all over the world, being as famous as she was.
Yeah.
She carried transmissions to England about airfields, harbors, and German troops, German troop concentrations in the west of France. And one of the things is that one of the ways that she did it is that she carried it. And a lot of, and other musicians did do this as well, who were part of the resistance efforts in Europe and during World War II. She carried it on sheet music.
Oh, my God. I love it.
Right? Like, really, really, like, one of the best ways to do it. You know what I mean? Later, in 1941, she and her entourage went to the French colonies, North Africa. The same reason was Baker's health. And she was recovering from another case of pneumonia. But the real reason was continuing to help the resistance. So she also became, and this is like a huge part of her whole life as being like a humanitarian, is that she became part of the French resistance and the major major part of the French Resistance in North Africa. Even people have talked about in the movie, like Casablanca, like there are like elements of her character in the movie Casablanca, things like that. From there, from her base in Morocco, she did make tours in Spain, and she also basically continued to gather information, collect information. Later in her time in North Africa, though, she developed an infection that basically required her to get a hysterectomy, and it was a really bad infection. And she also developed sepsis as well.
Yeah, of course.
So she pretty much almost died in North Africa.
Oh my God.
And was in very ill health. And because of that, and because of the hysterectomy, obviously she was never able to have children.
Right.
So.
Oh my God. And a surgery like that in that time is just nightmare. Like, it's a nightmare even now.
Yeah.
So, you know.
And it was also a time too, granted she was a woman that, she was a person that, was very much so active in many, many aspects of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But because of her upbringing and because of the disadvantages that she suffered from, she definitely wanted to bestow, a new life onto her offspring.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about that, she wanted that. She married a couple times wanting to develop family, and I don't think she ever really did with a lot of these men.
Mm-hmm.
But while in her time in North Africa, and she finally recovered, during the war effort, they needed an entertainer to perform for the troops, and they were short on entertainers. And she agreed to sing for the troops. And basically, again, this is like Beyonce being like, I just came out of a fucking coma, I'll sing for you bitches.
Yeah.
So she agreed to sing for the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really what really established the rest of her mission on humanitarian work for the rest of her life, where the troops were segregated. And again, in World War II, troops were segregated by race.
Mm.
And the black troops were singing in the back, the white troops were singing in the front. And she was just like, fuck all of that.
Yeah.
I'm not performing a goddamn single note until you mix the crowd.
Yeah.
She's like, and they're
hell
like,
yeah.
They're like, we can't do that. Like, how could we possibly ever do it? She's like, I'm not singing another note until you mix the crowd.
Yeah.
And that's what really started it really set off for her, and it's really set a tone for her performance, for her demands, for this, the example she's saying across the country or across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then especially in entertainment.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
During this time as well, she met her husband that she was with for the next 14 years, because I don't think she ever got married. She never got married after this, and this was like her last relationship. But his name was Joe Bouillon, and she met him in 1947. And again, they lasted for 14 years until they divorced. And during that time, after her time in the war, after meeting Joe, she had like a whole new renaissance on life.
Yeah.
And the 50s set off a whole new renaissance in terms of like the new Josephine Baker. She revived things like the Folies Bergère in 1949. And that really like bolstered her recognition as well, like especially after being like a war hero. And she then in 1951 was invited back to the States for a nightclub engagement in Miami. After winning the public battle over desegregating the club's audience, Baker followed up with like a sold out show at the club and a national tour. So in 1951 in Miami, she was finally given all the things that she finally got all the things that she never got to have when she came here the first time,
right,
as a famous performer.
Right.
A hotel room in like a nice area, being able to walk through the front entrance,
mm-hmm,
being able to have a proper dressing room, all the things that, it may sound like they're super like bougie or whatever, but like as two performers here, this is called space that you need to actually like live and breathe in.
It makes all the difference.
Truly. It makes all the difference. Yeah. And it's not even makes all the difference in terms of, it's just like, it literally helps you breathe and live.
Yeah.
And so, but also at the same time, they had a segregated audience because it's fucking Miami. It's Florida.
Right.
There's still racist shit now.
Yeah.
And she refused to play for a segregated audience. And I think they shut the show down for like 3 days. Like, she would not perform.
Oh my God.
Until they like let the audience be mixed.
Love it.
And that's what started her like national tour. And so I mean, cool. She was doing like she was having audiences of like size of like 100,000 people. Like 100,000 people actually showed up in Harlem when she was honored with the title from the NAACP's Woman of the Year title.
Crazy.
And then in 1952, Baker was hired to crown the Queen of Cavalcade of Jazz, which is a famed jazz like festival that happened in Wrigley Field in Los Angeles. It also featured like performers like Roy Brown and Anne Mae Wynburn. However, just before that in New York, she had an incident at the Stork Club, which was a famous restaurant back in the day. It was like, what is it now? Like, where are the famous restaurants, like, in New York? All of them, pretty much.
Yeah, like, yeah, I'm like,
But, like, it was, like, the place to go. Like, uh-huh. It was white tie dining, you know what I mean? Right. Like, everyone went there. Grace Kelly, you know, Greta Garbo, like, all the bitches, all the people.
All the bitches.
Truman Capote, all of them. And Walter Winchell, who's a really famous radio host at the time. He uh-huh. was... basically, like, the Jay Leno of, like, radio at the time. There was a really big incident where the Stork Club was known... they didn't have, like, an actual written rule that they would not serve people of color or Jews. But, because it was the 50s. Ugh. But they often discouraged those customers from coming in and having, like, any kind of service. So Josephine Baker went there the first time, I think, in, like, her first tour, or she uh-huh. tried to go, and they refused her, and she wouldn't go, and she didn't come back. And then when she came back to the States, she's like, I'm going to go again.
Yeah.
And she went in with Grace Kelly at the time. Or no, she didn't go in with Grace Kelly. Grace Kelly was there.
Uh-huh.
And she went in, and she sat down. She was invited, and they gave her, you know, like, just all this beautiful, like, be our guest motherfucking service. Like, it was fucking Beauty and the Beast. Uh-huh. And they did not serve her guests. They, like, didn't give them water, didn't give them men, just let them sit.
Oh, my God.
And she made a big fuss, and she was like, what the fuck? Like, these people have food, these people have drinks, we don't have a single goddamn thing.
Right.
And they were like, miss, like, please don't, like, make a scene. She's like, make a scene, like, who the hell do you think you are? And she walked out, and apparently it was reported that Grace Kelly walked out with her in support of her with the Prince of Monaco. And
yes, with the Prince of Monaco, okay.
And became friends after that.
Love it.
For the rest of their lives.
Love it.
Grace Kelly actually helped Josephine Baker when she was on really hard times and gave her an apartment when she lost Demi-Land later in her life.
Mm-hmm.
But the instances like this, like, really kind of, like, started to affect her standing with both activism and the Black community, because people saw her as being this super wealthy Black woman who sold herself out to France. And they felt like she had more involved with France than she did with the States.
Yeah.
And so this became, like, this huge thing about... there's also, like, a time during communism as well, and, like, the fear of communism.
Right.
In the 50s. And Black performers, Paul Robeson, were, you know, being tried for communism and being accused of communism. And so...
right, yeah, it was a big thing.
So they accused Josephine Baker of communism, you know, as she was doing a lot of this work. And eventually, she was denied access back into the States when she finally left. Little known fact, which I did not realize, but she is the only female speaker to actually be invited to speak at the March on Washington and spoke on the March on Washington.
Wow.
Which I did not realize. Which is funny because, you know, we always watch videos of the March on Washington and it's Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that's the only video we will ever see.
Right.
And there are so many other speakers.
Yeah.
Following all of this, Josephine Baker moved back to the States, or moved back to France.
Right.
And started to just really develop her life in France, and not necessarily, because she felt betrayed by her work in the U.S. pretty much, and like her like reception in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And she really tried to make it and tried to make something of it, but just like, you know, just had to go eventually and move back with Joe Bouillon. And they adopted for the next, like, 10 years, 11 fucking kids?
They had 13.
13 kids?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
13 kids?
Yeah, which is, like, you know...
13 kids?
Wonderful, but also it was absolutely, like she talked about it, it was completely like a political move, and she made each adoption very public, and she would actually like make these kids perform and do appearances and stuff just to show, and because they were all of different ethnic backgrounds.
And so I want people to also understand a serious context about this too, is that she was the first person to actually have the term Rainbow Tribe.
Rainbow Tribe!
So that's why I said Angelina Jolie was trying to be her, because we remember when Angelina Jolie was adopting all these kids.
Right.
And they were
from all different countries
and she was developing her Rainbow Tribe. That was Josephine Baker that did that. First celebrity humanitarian who did the Rainbow Tribe.
Right.
But it was also, I think as well, too, there's a huge context about the trauma that she experienced as a young girl, the trauma she experienced of not having a solid home life of any kind or feeling any kind of safety. And then also seeing pretty much the world almost implode on itself during World War II, then seeing the world try to devour itself in the 50s with all the civil rights work she was doing, you know, there was it brought her to a point of wanting to develop a world in which kids are not raised to be racist.
Exactly. But because of her upbringing,
she
knew how to be a performer, but she didn't necessarily know how to be a parent.
Exactly.
So it was definitely like a show. The kids were... you know, a statement.
Oh, and yeah, she developed like, she developed like little stories for like these wild, exotic romantic stories, origin stories about how these kids were found.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and even in the movie too, like they show like how she was just very headstrong about everything she wanted to do and like how she wanted to develop this. And Joe Bouillon just kind of had to go with it.
Right.
And eventually just left, you know, like in the middle of the night, like just left her and all the kids.
Well, because while the kids were young and cute, it was a cute show. But as they got older and she suddenly had like 13 teenagers.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I don't know how to deal with this at all.
Yeah.
Actually.
It's a lot of fucking like grown ass kids.
It's a lot. It's a lot
of grown ass kids out here.
And when you hear interviews with some of the kids that she adopted, like as grown people, they were saying how confusing it was for them because their entire childhood was a performance.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was like, oh.
Yeah.
Now we got to just like figure it out.
And it's interesting too. I mean, they definitely loved their mom.
Yeah, of course.
They definitely loved their mom. And I think that's really interesting too, is I think that later in her life, I think she figured out how to be a mom again, like finally figured out how to be a mom. As she like got older and like, you know, just all the life experience caught up with her and everything.
Right.
You were so far away from the microphone when you said that. You were leaning way back.
I gotta lean back. I need to remember to move the
you
comfy
need to
chair
move to the comfy
here.
Chair. You need to move the comfy chair. Oh my god, me and her like wearing the same outfit. Oh my god, we're wearing big sweaters, long dress. But I know you need to get you need to get comfortable.
Lean back.
I know. But I just found, but yeah, like this whole idea too is like this is happening in the starting in the 60s and during this like very tumultuous time of like racial issues across the board.
Yeah.
And all the while she is cultivating this own little small world in Des Moulins, which is another thing is that she was able to do this in Des Moulins. So also understand like how big her estate was. It featured hotels, a farm, horse, like a stable. The children were singing and dancing for audiences. So this all happened on her estate.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
She charged admission for visitors to enter and partake in the activities. And then also include watching the children play.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Their play was performative and people were paying to watch these kids. It was like a zoo.
And she said that her children were as metaphors, living examples of what humanity should look like. And diverse children were used in a sort of attack against racism, basically what we were talking about. However, which also is really interesting, too, is that she also raised them in different religions as well. Now, Josephine Baker herself was Roman Catholic, converted to Roman Catholicism a little later in her, or by the time she was like in her 30s. But she raised her children in different religions to further like show how the world can exist and coexist. And so she had children from Algeria, raising one of them Muslim and one of them Catholic. She had a member of the Tribi, Jean-Claude Baker, who she said she wanted a doll. apparently. And then another, she adopted from Japan, Akio, mm-hmm. who she raised like in the Buddhist religion or something. So it's interesting. I have it here. Okay. So then she had as well two daughters, French born Marianne and Moroccan born Stelina. This girl is Stelina, which is the best name ever.
Yeah, that's pretty dope.
10 sons. 10 fucking sons.
Yeah.
Korean born Jeanneau. Japanese Akio. Colombian born Luis. Finnish born Jari. French born Jean Claude and Noel. Israeli born Moaz. Algerian born Brahim. Ivorian from the Ivory Coast, Kofi. Venezuelan, Mara. And then Sir Sometime Baker lived with her children in the chateau right before she lost. And then eventually she did lose her chateau.
Yeah.
Like, she did eventually lose her chateau. I think a lot of her kids had moved out by then. But she did eventually lose her chateau, which I think was really sad.
Yeah. Well, they really did go from extreme wealth to extreme poverty very quickly.
Very quickly. Well, and it's interesting, too. It's like, it is extreme poverty and isn't extreme poverty. It is extreme poverty. Like, what we think of as extreme poverty is not necessarily extreme poverty. Like, their extreme poverty is not our extreme poverty.
Well, yeah.
You know what I mean?
But they were struggling.
Yeah, because she still kept a maid, I think, from my understanding. She still kept a maid. She still kept, like, minimal staff. I think she kept a maid and a gardener up until they had to, like, take the estate. Because you can still pay them from the estate. Mm-hmm. Like, with, like, goods and things like that that the state's producing. So in her later years, she did convert to Roman Catholicism. So I was actually wrong. She converted in her later years, but she raised the kids in different religions before that. Sorry. In her later years, she did lose her castle. And like I said before, Princess Grace of Monaco, her and Grace Jones, or Grace Jones, her, Josephine Baker, sorry, I'm thinking about
Freudian slip. We love you, Grace, so much.
Her and Josephine Baker remained friends since the Historic Club, and Princess Grace offered Josephine an apartment near Monaco for her to live in, so she wouldn't be homeless, basically. They mm-hmm. basically almost like threw her out on her own ass, like threw her out of her house, because she was like, I'm not leaving this fucking house.
Right.
Which is just so sad, too, because, like, you know, this little tidbit goes into a larger issue with the idea of black wealth mm-hmm. and the passing of black wealth down to, by generation, generational black wealth, and how that's always been something that's so difficult to hold on to. Mm-hmm. But because, like, black people, we never, a lot for the most part, especially for her, did not have access to the knowledge of finance and banking and what that meant.
Right.
And so, making a lot of money, yes, great. I made a lot of money. I have a lot of money. I can spend it.
Uh-huh.
But then what do you do to keep that money and hold on to that money without having to then go work and make a lot of money?
Right.
You know what I mean? And so, and that's, I mean, like nowadays it's a lot better because we have a lot more resources. People are talking about it. But then, like, that really did not exist. So black people, yes, there were wealthy black people, for sure. There's a very vast history of wealthy black people. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, the idea of generational black wealth is an other history that's always been a problem.
Yeah.
And so thinking about this, like, she's not the only star, especially at this time, a black star, that lived in extreme wealth, extreme success, but then lived in extreme poverty, mm-hmm. quote unquote.
Yeah.
Were you
gonna say? Yeah, I believe it was Jean-Claude that was the only kid of hers that actually went into, like, the biz. And started that super famous, like, restaurant bar in New York.
Yes.
And was there, like, forever.
Mm-hmm.
He had that place for, like, 40 or 50 years.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Actually, yes. But I think the thing is, I think she actually bought that first. Like, Josephine's or, like, Baker or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. She, I think, from my understanding, she actually bought that first while she was in the States.
Uh-huh.
And opened it as a club in Harlem. And then he took it over.
Yeah. To try to, like, let her legacy live on. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So by 1968, Baker is back on stage at the Olympia in Paris and in Belgrade and at the Carnegie Hall in 1973. She did performances at Gala du Cirque in Paris in 1974. And on April 8th, 1975, Baker starred in a retrospective review at the Bambino in Paris.
Yeah, and she was much older at this point.
Yes, she was like... much older. This was celebrating her 50 years in show business. 50 fucking years.
Wild.
Of your own goddamn review. It's like the Cher farewell tour.
Right.
Like, finally farewell, though.
Yeah.
And the review was financed by none other than Prince Rania of Monaco and Princess Grace, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis.
Yeah.
And opened with, obviously, like, huge reviews. It was a packed house. The opening night audience featured people like Sophia Loren and Mick Jagger and Shirley Bassey, Diana Ross, Liza Minnelli, all the people she inspired.
Diamonds are forever.
However, in this, I know, right? However, and this gives me chills to say, but... because obviously this already happened, so I can't actually be too sad about this. But, you know, she, in the final moments of her life, in the final days of her life, there's a full video of this show that we actually need to post on Facebook.
Yes.
There's a full video of this actual show, of this specific opening night at the Bambino in Paris, of her doing this huge review.
Oh, my God.
And it's beautiful. It's amazing. Her body looks snatched as fuck.
Yeah.
Like, her moves are everything. And she's so much older, but she is giving it.
Yes.
Giving it. And she sings her heart out.
Mm-hmm.
4 days later, Baker was found lying peacefully in her bed, surrounded by newspapers with glowing reviews of her performance.
Aw.
She was in a coma after suffering from a cerebral hemorrhage.
Oof.
She was taken to the Petit Salpêtrier Hospital, where she died at the age of 68. On April 12th, 1975.
Wow. That's so crazy. She went out with a bang, though.
I, like, almost want to cry right now.
I know,
just picturing and just knowing, like, she died with... I'm literally going to cry right now. But she died... I know you're about to feel it, too. I know. Don't. We can't both cry.
We can't cry.
We can't both cry. I'm literally crying right now, everyone.
Ugh.
But she died with... She was a woman that was born into so much tumultuousness and then died with so much love, literally surrounding her. I know we are both literally sobbing on this podcast.
Well, because
right now,
that's the ultimate thing for an artist, right?
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine if she was found surrounded by shit reviews?
Yeah, or pills, know? Or like...
Right, like, you know, the legacy is always the question.
And also, it also proves this. The amount of love that you give to the world comes back to you tenfold.
Okay, now I'm going to cry.
I know. But that's what she did.
That has to be real, though. That has to be real.
Yes, she did. And she dedicated her life to that.
And that is the concept that I live my life with every goddamn day.
We
you
all
and I
should.
You and I both do. It's like...
We all should.
We have to put the love that we want to see out into the world.
We all should. Well...
Oh, Josephine.
I know. Well, let's... Okay, we're going to stop there, everyone. We are sobbing right now. Are you sobbing, Alexia? You're not crying, are you?
That
she's
was so
keeping
good.
It together. She has to stay strong.
I know.
For us.
Like, let's not. She's such an amazing woman. Number one, people, please go on to our podcast page on Full Service Radio, like and review us, and on Apple Podcasts, like and review us.
Yeah, we're trying to find those sticky listeners.
Yes.
The ones that are actually got the pause for the cause, that are down for what we're doing.
Also, I'm going to put in this little other campaign. I want there to be a Josephine Baker biopic.
Yes.
So let's put this out there together, Mundy.
Okay.
We need everyone to start urging one of these. We need to urge fucking Jordan Peele or Tyler Perry to not use his writers, but a different writer and a different director, but use his money to produce a Josephine Baker, very well funded, beautiful.
It's got to happen.
Respectful and honorable Ooh. Biopic about this amazing, amazing woman.
Yes.
Because after doing this today, I'm so much more empowered about life.
Yay.
I know, we both are.
Yay.
And there's just so much in the world to live for, and there's so much in the world to fight for, and stories like hers remind us of that.
Yes.
She's a fashion icon. She was a performance and entertainment icon. She was a humanitarian icon.
A trailblazer.
She's a fucking literal war hero.
Yes.
Medal of Honor.
Yes.
War hero. Like,
yes.
All right, people. We're going to go.
So y'all go out there and see what you can do to put some love into this world today.
Stay ballsy, stay brave.
Stay ballsy, stay brave.
We got to remember to do that.
I was thinking about that today all the way here. I was like, yeah.
Stay ballsy, stay brave. Be the RKO. Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.